The chief says attacks on aid workers in Gaza are unconscionable. This after an Israeli airstrike killed 7 aid workers. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Binyaz. Thanks for joining us. The Syrian government has held a ceremony in Damascus to pay homage to the 7 Iranian military advisors killed on Monday's Israeli attack on the consular section of Iran's embassy. We were joined by our correspondent Ibrahim Bate from Damascus, who said the martyrs are commemorated for playing a significant role in fighting terrorism in Syria.
This is a first of its kind in Syria to commemorate the funeral of the martyrs. This is the second martyr here. The first one were all the martyrs now, 1, 2, 3 martyrs now heading to the ambulances, which will after this go to Sayyida Zainab Shrine to be heading to Iran later. We were at the embassy where we also met several governmental party members, prominent party members, who came to pay their respect and give condolences to the Iranian people, to the Republic, to the Islamic Republic of Iran, for the martyrs of the IRGC. We have met with also the representative of Al-Nujaba movement. He said that the Islamic resistance in Iraq will take it personally and respond to this attack. They started already with this response to this treacherous attack. The ceremony now begun. We are here currently bidding farewell to these martyrs who gave their lives while wearing their military uniform, defending Syria against terrorism, supporting the resistance, giving aid to the resistance in Gaza.
The Iranian ambassador to Syria says the recent Israeli attack on the consular section of Iran's embassy will further strengthen the bond between Iran and Syria and render the resistance front more determined to achieve victory in Gaza.
This is unprecedented in the world. This is a crime that not only targeted Iran and Syria, it also violates international law, especially the 1961 Vienna Convention has been violated. Well, these are the martyrs of Al-Aqsa that we have called the martyrs of Al-Aqsa. For all those who have been struggling on the path of jihad, they belong to all of them. And definitely, these martyrs make us more adamant in order to fight and annihilate this regime. And definitely, the relations among the countries of the resistance front, especially Iran and Syria, will be further augmented. Well, naturally, on the basis of international law that all countries have been adopting, we have the right, reserve the right to respond within the same context.
The UN Security Council has held an emergency meeting on the latest Israeli attack on the consular section of the Iranian embassy in Syria. Addressing the event, Iran's deputy representative to the UN called on the world body to vehemently denounce Israel's violation of the international regulations.
Regrettably, the absence of accountability and the Council's inaction has only encouraged and even emboldened this regime to continue its violation unchecked. It is high time for the Security Council to shoulder its responsibility and address the real threat to international peace and security. The Security Council must promptly fulfill its duty in response to Israel's reckless defiance. Urgent and enforceable measures must be taken to compel this regime to uphold its obligations.
Zahra Shadi said that Israel is defying Security Council resolutions and shows disregard for its international obligations. Syria's ambassador to the UN also called the attack a grave violation of international laws and norms. He said the Arab country holds Israel and the U.S. fully accountable. The Syrian official added the Israeli regime would not have dared attack other nations' diplomatic premises if it was not for Washington's blind support. The Russian ambassador, whose country has called the meeting, or had called the meeting, slammed the airstrike as a flagrant violation of Syria's sovereignty. He said that Israel seeks to further fuel the regional conflicts. China's envoy also condemned Israel's attacks as a grave violation of the UN Charter and international law, and a breach of the sovereignty of both Syria and Iran. Political commentator Masoud Shajarat joined us from London earlier and commented on the Israeli attack against the Iranian embassy's consular section in Syria. He said the aggressive act was absolutely against international law and an escalation of insecurity in the region.
I mean, it really is outrageous. I mean, the fact of the matter is there is no question that this is unlawful, this is provocative, this is actually goes against all aspects of international law. This is escalation of the insecurity in the whole region and indeed beyond. There is really no question on this. I mean, I don't think anyone with a slight intellect will be able to say anything other than these factual realities. But what is really so shocking is not the fact that there is a silence by the international community, is the fact that the Western so-called allies under the leadership of United States are actually encouraging this by arming and supporting and giving total sort of support to all barbaric action over the last few months of this rogue state, this regime. And that is why it's been encouraged to do this. And by doing so, we are sleepwalking into conflict going much wider and indeed becoming a world conflict and engulfing not just nations in the region, but far beyond.
A joint report by the World Bank and the UN shows the Israeli war in Gaza has caused damages of around $18.5 billion to Gaza's critical infrastructure. The report says the structural damage caused by the Israeli carpet bombing of Gaza has affected every sector of the Palestinian territory's economy. The damages are equivalent to 97% of the combined GDP of the West Bank and Gaza in 2022. The report covers only the first 4 months of the Israeli genocide in Gaza and embodies some aspects of the besieged strip's humanitarian crisis as well. It has found out that more than half of the territory's population is on the brink of famine. At least 32,975 Palestinians, mostly women and children, have been killed since Israel began its war in early October. In our News Review program, we have discussed the brutal Israeli airstrike on a vehicle that was carrying international aid workers from a U.S.-based charity in the Gaza Strip. The attack that killed seven aid workers has already sparked global condemnations. Let's take a listen to what our guests had to say on the Israeli brutalities.
News Review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, the UN Secretary General is denounced as unconscionable the Israeli killing of several international aid workers on duty in the Gaza Strip.
The devastating Israeli airstrikes that killed World Central Kitchen personnel yesterday bring the number of aid workers killed in this conflict to 196, including more than 175 members of our own UN staff. This is unconscionable. It demonstrates yet again the urgent need for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, the unconditional release of all hostages, and the expansion of humanitarian aid into Gaza, as the Security Council demanded in its resolution last week. The resolution must be implemented without delay.
Meanwhile, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says the war on Gaza has witnessed the highest number of aid worker deaths ever recorded in any conflict. An Israeli airstrike left seven aid workers associated with the U.S.-based charity World Central Kitchen dead in the Gaza Strip on Monday. The head of the charity called the incident a targeted attack, saying the strike targeted humanitarian organizations showing up in dire situations when food is being used as a weapon of war. The Israeli killing of the World Central Kitchen aid staff has drawn international reactions. Western countries have called on Israel to offer an explanation. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have academic broadcaster and investigative researcher David Miller joining us from Bristol. Also, we have Director of Center for Muslim Affairs, Mr. Jahangir Mohammad, who's joining us from Manchester. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with David Miller. The Israelis have reportedly killed around 200 aid workers since this genocidal massacre started. That is no accident, is it?
Well, no, of course, it's not an accident, but that doesn't stop the Zionists and their apologists from pretending that it might have been an accident or it's a terrible mistake or any of the various things that have been said by them on social media since then. But it's a very curious set of affairs. I mean, the first thing to say is that, look, they are deliberately targeting people who are trying to help the Palestinians. Journalists, health workers, aid workers, anyone who might provide food to the Palestinians is a target for the Israelis. And that's, of course, part of their genocidal strategy to make it impossible to protect Palestinian lives.
The head of the World Central Kitchen said that this was indeed a targeted attack, which strengthens the discussion that Israelis are purposefully targeting humanitarian organizations and aid workers. Break that down for us, and what are the Israelis achieving by carrying out this type of murderous behavior?
We can see from what happens in Syria and in Lebanon, they're able to precisely hit the targets that they want. Whereas in Gaza, they claim, well, it was an accident, or we didn't know what we were targeting. So I think the chances of them not knowing what they were targeting are very slim. They knew what they were doing. And of course, the goal is that this is not a new strategy. Even before the war on Gaza, for the last 16 years, Israel and its supporters worldwide have been trying to get charities that work in Gaza closed down. The aim is to starve the Palestinians. Before it was a slow starvation and genocide, now it's a fast one. And they want to either force the Palestinians to leave by starvation, by massacring them, or they want to have a slow death.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Academic broadcaster and investigative researcher David Miller joining us from Bristol, and thanks to Director of Center for Muslim Affairs, Mr. Jahangir Mohammad, joining us from Manchester. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but stick around, there's plenty more to come here.
Tensions remain high between Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement and Israel since the regime launched its genocidal war in Gaza. Both sides have been exchanging fire, but Israel has intensified its attacks on Lebanese civilians in recent weeks. Earlier, we were joined by our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, to know more about the latest Israeli strikes on civilian areas in southern Lebanon and the potential Hezbollah's retaliatory attacks.
We know that the Israelis have heavily bombarded the natural reserves of the towns of Ramya and the outskirts of Ait Ashab. We know at least 60 phosphorus bombs were fired on the natural reserves of Ramya, which is considered one of the biggest, one of the largest in the country. We also had some 20 artillery missiles that were targeted also on these two towns, in addition to another 20 missiles that were targeted, that were launched from the tanks, from the Israeli tanks on that side. Now, we know also from Israeli reports that that could be a sign that there was a Hezbollah operation in that side, which is considered the eastern part of the border, since there were sirens that were sounding in the eastern side of the Galilee region and those settlements there. And usually when you have that type of rage from the Israeli army, that usually signifies that Hezbollah was able to inflict heavy losses upon the Israelis. And we're not just talking about destruction of maybe a settlement or the destruction of the post and devices and hardware, but we're also talking about losses within the Israeli military personnel, perhaps soldiers, which is something, of course, the Israelis don't admit to, but it is clear and evident from their reports that there are usually many Israeli soldiers that are taken to hospital, in addition to the fact that you have a lot of officials and even commanders and officers from the Israeli army that are talking about the heavy price they are paying on the northern side, which is, of course, the occupied Palestinian territory in the Galilee region. So that means, although they are not admitting to it officially, they are losing soldiers on the ground in that area.
International Quds Day is an annual pro-Palestinian event marked on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. The day was designated by the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, in 1979, in solidarity with Palestinians. People worldwide will mark this year's Quds Day on the coming Friday. Our correspondent in Belfast, Dieter Reinisch, has asked some people there about the event and its importance to the Palestinian cause. Let's take a listen.
I think that the Iranian government choosing such a symbolic day as the last Friday in Ramadan as Al-Quds Day and as a day of celebrating solidarity with the Palestinians really shows that solidarity with Palestine is their number one foreign policy priority and has been since the revolution. So I think that Palestinians, especially in these days in midst of war, starvation and genocide, will treasure this act of solidarity more than in any year before.
And I believe fully that the Israeli ambassador should be expelled from Ireland. I believe that everyone has a right to protest and should be on the streets calling for this genocide, this mass murder, not only to be stopped, but we should be calling for Netanyahu to be in The Hague and the International War Crimes Committee should be taking him for the crimes against humanity that he has created in Gaza. As I said, one thing to murder innocent people with bombs and with bullets, but to use hunger, starvation and famine as a way of murdering and wiping out innocent men, women and children is abhorrent and is the worst crime in humanity in a long, long time.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kHz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Cancer, the new trailblazers.
One of the oldest and most widespread diseases in the world, cancer has always existed and is found in all living things, including plants. It was once thought to be related to the humours, to be contagious or viral in origin. Today it is believed that the cause may be genetic. In every age, new weapons have been unsheathed against cancer, but none have succeeded in vanquishing it. And yet scientists now are able to decipher some of its most intricate processes. Could these advances have been misleading? Could they have in fact led the scientific community astray?
It now appears very likely that we got lost in the details. Our focus was wrong. We were looking at the details of the engine in the car when that wasn't really the problem.
We tend to research the details without seeing the big picture. We lose the forest for the trees.
Einstein said for an idea that people don't think is crazy in the beginning, there is no hope.
The time has come in America when the same kind of concentrated effort that split the atom and took man to the moon should be turned toward conquering this dread disease.
It's now been over 40 years since the war against cancer was declared by one government or another.
La lutte contre le cancer s'est fixée comme objectif.
70% of the cancers that were fatal in the 1950s can now be cured. But such undeniable achievements are, in the end, relatively minimal. In spite of the many billions that have been invested in cancer research in the last half century, mortality rates have not decreased as much as expected. The disease continues to kill 8 million people every year. But how well do we really know this enemy? And to begin with, how do we define it?
When you take these cells from the person and put it in a dish, or from an animal and put it in the dish, the genes are not fixed. They are regulated by context. They are regulated by microenvironment. So that just clarified a lot of things for me, that again, context or microenvironment, and in this case, the architecture of the tissue was very, very important. And once you destroyed the architecture, that, in combination with the oncogene, could make a tumor.
In a forest, if there's a plant or an animal species that proliferates to the point of destroying the ecosystem, that is literally the equivalent of cancer in the body. Rather than seeing the body as something that functions under the centralized control of our DNA, if we see it as a self-regulating system, like a forest or an ocean, we will then start to look at how the element that is proliferating gets access to nutritional resources and will study the predators. So, for example, if a certain type of rabbit suddenly begins to multiply to the point of destroying the forest, we're not going to say, oh, the rabbit has mutated. We would wonder instead if carrots hadn't become more abundant for some reason, or if some of the other species that would normally compete with the rabbits hadn't disappeared, or whether the foxes that kept a check on the rabbit population hadn't some kind of problem that year. And so all of a sudden, instead of looking for mutations, you're faced with a more global vision of balances and imbalances.
People like me have argued, instead of
looking at all of these changes all the time, the genetic changes and all this bioinformatic analysis and the constant need to sequence, as maybe we should just step back and look at some other ways to think about cancer.
There are various ways of changing tumor metabolism, of improving it. You can do it through your diet, in other words, by reducing the amount of glucose that you consume and by reducing the amount of food that you eat in general. That's one possibility. However, it hasn't really been tested. Many people do it, but to be honest, we have very few of the proper, clear-cut kind of studies that scientists are so fond of. Another way is to work with the kinds of drugs that specifically target those circuits. That's the approach we've chosen because it's easier to study.
There are limitations, though, of the work done in petri dishes and in animals. And in relation to metformin, one of the major concerns is that much of the work has used metformin in concentrations that are unsafe in humans. So it's very difficult to translate much of that work into the clinical setting.
Every year, over 1 million women around the world are diagnosed with breast cancer, and nearly half of them will die from the disease. Yet testing an old medication like metformin, which might prove to be effective, was an uphill battle. It took 10 years for Pamela Goodwin to obtain the funds needed for this study.
When we started the company in 2002, and again, it was based on targeting this unique metabolic properties of cancer cells, we were probably one of maybe 20 or 40 people that we spoke with who were even aware of Otto Warburg. And occasionally we would meet with potential investors who were older, guys in their 60s and 70s, who when we described what we were doing, they would say, oh, you're targeting the Warburg effect. Is that if you can develop an effective therapy that really targets the Warburg effect, you may have a much broader therapeutic that would treat a much wider variety of cancers than would be the case with these molecularly targeted approaches.
Threshold Pharmaceuticals is testing a new drug called TH302 in several countries. In Germany, oncologist Peter Hohenberger is using it on 10 patients who have advanced stage cancer with disseminated tumors. The aim of the trial is to evaluate the effectiveness of combining TH302 with other treatments.
In a therapeutic study, what we want to find out is how effective the treatment is. This can be measured by the fact that the tumors are shrinking, and so that's a positive sign. Our primary goal, however, is to extend the life of our patients. Of course, it takes a long time to develop a drug that we can then prescribe for our patients. It's a process that often takes 4 or 5 years. Before we can use a drug, all of the relevant studies have to be conducted in order to prove that it actually offers something more. For our patients, of course, the procedure is too long.
Since it takes such a long time to get a new drug out and onto the market, many patients will never get the opportunity to try a new treatment, even if it has a good chance of prolonging their lives.
The time frame for conventional, standardized clinical trials does not match the time frame of someone diagnosed with cancer, who is in a hurry, and that's understandable.
Since 2009, Dr. Lauren Schwartz has been advocating the idea that a combination of drugs, including metformin, which is already on the market for other diseases, could act on cell metabolism. Tests carried out on mice have indeed been very encouraging. Such drugs are inexpensive. Their side effects are already known, and combining them makes them more effective. However, in spite of his repeated requests, he has been unable to obtain the authorization and the funding needed to conduct clinical trials on patients.
Everything we've done has been published. We've had numerous articles in well-known international reviews. And yet there has been absolutely no response. It got to the point that I decided I had to write a book about what I was thinking. And that's when the patients started coming to me. And since those who contacted me knew they had very little time left, I felt I had to inform them of what I thought had a chance of helping them.
Some of the members of the association Facing Cancer Together in the French city of Nantes have decided to try this experimental treatment. The
trials we've conducted come under the heading of compassionate use. Physicians are torn between two obligations, between two laws. On the one hand, trials that are extremely regulated, and on the other, assisting a person in danger. We're authorized to prescribe treatment when it concerns people who are in danger.
Is the treatment prescribed by Dr. Schwartz the miracle we've all been waiting for? He himself refrains from drawing conclusions with regard to a possible or permanent cure.
So far, we've treated, both myself and other people, over 100 patients. And several articles have been published that suggest, and I think the term suggest is the appropriate term, that suggests that we are able to slow down the progression of the disease. In certain cases, we've seen a decrease in the number of tumor markers. Other cases could be called miracles. In the majority of cases, unfortunately, the effect is temporary, and I don't understand why it's only temporary. In other words, they improve, and then afterwards they relapse. But even if we were able to make just a tiny breakthrough, it may not be enough for the patients under my care, but it's still pretty good. Of course, what's also important is to take what we already have, which is far from being perfect, and try to improve it. Combining it with chemotherapy would probably be a good thing, and it's likely there are other agents that could be introduced. At any rate, it's quite clear that we only have a part of the picture.
But I think that the permanent eradication of cancer is unlikely. I recognize this is not going to be a popular view, but it's a realistic view. My goal would be to reduce the incidence as much as we can, and I think it will be important that we manage cancer using agents that are the least toxic that we can use, and that will prolong life as long as possible.
Whether there are new drugs or old drugs, we still don't know how effective they will be. Will the metabolic approach run into the same limitations as the other cancer treatments?
We can't stay up on the surface of things, think that it will be simple, that cancer is a problem that we can solve with three or four drugs. We feel like we're advancing, and as we advance, it's like we're opening up a series of black boxes. We're bringing in some light, but then the light shows us that a little bit further on, there's another black box. With this new idea, which emphasizes metabolism as an important factor, it is imperative that we not fall prey to the sort of oversimplification that could lead to the same kind of problems and disappointments that we had with the previous paradigms.
It will be important, though, to conduct the proper trials. And those trials will be large. They'll be much larger than the 3,600-patient study we're doing. They could include tens of thousands of individuals.
Why is it taking us so long to implement genuine wide-scale clinical trials for these drugs?
It is possible that the policies of the funding agencies over the last decades have encouraged, for example, gene-oriented research on cancer and have discouraged or slowed down other kinds of research. If somebody would have sent in a grant application on metabolism 20 years ago, they would have had a very hard time justifying why they wanted to work on metabolism.
The government has to almost, at least for the next 20 years, has to set up a special program for metabolism. And I'm being very serious about this because there are not enough people who can judge metabolism. You just have to say, we're going to put a certain amount of the budget and the people who know metabolism will help us decide, and we're going to try to encourage other people to get into it.
But I'm afraid right now there is a lot of conservatism, and there is not enough money. And there are a lot of scientists out there, and they want papers, they want quick answers, and there is huge competition, and the kind of experiments we do takes a long time. And not very many people are as stubborn as I am. We need people to have the courage of their conviction.
It's crucial to continue taking an empirical approach. Look, we built boats long before we had any understanding of how boats are able to float and move. In the same way, we need to use empirical methods, that is, conduct clinical trials when dealing with cancer. And that's the work of physicians. We've had a lot of progress in treating cancer, even though we still don't really understand why. So through the empirical approach, huge advances have been made through the trials we've done, through our errors and observations. Hopefully this will continue, and as we acquire a better understanding of what is going on, our results will improve.
When the science is strong enough that the scientific community feels it is valid to test the benefits of these drugs, we need to make it easier for future studies to be initiated and for future investigators to get the funding that they need. And that's the challenge in this area. It's not a scientific challenge, it's a societal challenge.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
ocean of dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another special edition of the program The Ocean of Dua. In this special edition during the holy month of Ramadan, we will be having a look at different parts of the supplication Abu Hamza Sumali. We will be bringing you different commentaries on some parts of this dua. We'll be back after you listen to these parts.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ya Mawlai, bidhikrika aasha qalbi. وبمناجاتك بردت ألم الخوف عني فيا مولاي ويا مؤملي ويا منتهى سؤلي فرق بيني وبين ذنبي المانع لي من لزوم طاعتك فإنما أسألك لقديم الرجاء فيك وعظيم الطمع منك الذي أوجبته على نفسك من الرأفة والرحمة.
يا مولاي بذكرك عاش قلبي. O my master, in your remembrance my heart takes delight. وبمناجاتك بردت ألم الخوف عني. And with your prayers that I hold communion with you, I can benumb the pains of fear tormenting me. Dear listeners, we were discussing this part of the supplication of Abu Hamza Thumali. We mentioned the reason why Imam alayhi salam says, بِذِكْرِكَ عَاشَ قَلْبِي. We talked about the importance of remembrance throughout the different verses of the Holy Quran and the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. We also mentioned the reality and spirit of all forms of worship, and it was remembrance. And we also talked about the place of remembrance, which is the heart, and its different functions. Now, we said that as the words of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam show, one of the important effects of remembrance is the life of the heart. بِذِكْرِكَ عَاشَ قَلْبِي. This is the exact and explicit words of the Imam. Now, we said, we can understand from the Holy Quran and traditions of the Ahlul Bayt that man can have a life which is higher than those of plants and animals. But the point is that human life is more than the life of the animals and plants. In this regard, the Holy Quran states, أَوَمَنْ كَانَ مَيْتًا فَأَحْيَيْنَاهُ وَجَعَلْنَا لَهُ نُورًا يَمْشِي بِهِ فِي النَّاسِ كَمَنْ مَثَلُهُ فِي الظُّلُمَاتِ لَيْسَ بِخَارِجٍ مِنْهَا. Is he who was lifeless, then we gave him life and provided him with a light by which he walks among the people, like the one who dwells in a manifold darkness which he cannot leave? This is an important question. It can be inferred from this very verse that man can have a kind of life whose prerequisite is luminosity. So if man possesses this kind of nuraniyya, this kind of spirituality and luminosity, he is alive. Otherwise, we are not allowed to call him even human being, let alone calling him alive. Even if he possesses plant and animal life.
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it. And whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which He has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
Describing some kinds of human beings, which are apparently human beings, but they do not have the life of true humans, it is stated, فَالصُّورَةُ صُورَةُ إِنسَانٍ وَالْقَلْبُ قَلْبُ حَيْوَانٍ. His shape is that of a man, but his heart is that of a beast. لَا يَعْرِفُ بَابَ الْهُدَى فَيَتَّبِعَ. He does not know the door of guidance to follow. وَلَا بَابَ الْعَمَى فَيَصُدَّ عَنْهُ. He does not know the door of misguidance to avoid. فَذَلِكَ مَيِّتُ الْأَحْيَى. Those are living dead bodies. If you want to know who mayyitul ahya are, if you want to know who the living dead bodies are, these are the ones. In this line of dua Abu Hamza Thumali, when Imam says, بِذِكْرِكَ عَاشَ قَلْبِي, in your remembrance my heart takes delight, Imam Sajjad points to this superior life, the life whose essential element is the remembrance of the Almighty Allah. Just as man will die within a short span if oxygen is not available, the heart of the believer will also die if it ceases to receive that element of life, which is the remembrance of the Almighty Allah. If it ceases to remember Allah and becomes immersed in materiality, the heart of a believer will also die. And the point is, one of the levels of life is the life of faith. And perhaps it can be said that it is the true life of man. According to the transmitted traditions, the spirit of faith, or ruh al-iman, is what we call the source of life in the believer. Now, given this spirit, so long as he has not committed a sin, he possesses a different life. But as he commits a sin, this spirit separates from him. It gets further and further away by the man committing sin. So, as the true mu'min who has committed a sin repents and returns to God, this spirit returns to him. And apart from the spirit of faith, there are other types of spirits exclusive for the prophets and awliyaullah, such as the Holy Spirit, Ruhul Qudus, possessed by the Holy Prophet of Islam and the purified Imams. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Oh, Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, ya Allah, don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close, close to you through half my life. Ya
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell." This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour. Syria holds a funeral ceremony for Iran's IRGC military advisors martyred in Israel's Monday attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. The death toll from nearly 6 months of the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza standing at almost 33,000, mostly women and children.